Good evening, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay. And bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and certainly we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But we ask you to hold your calls for the time being because We have this evening Dr. Garth Nicholson, and for many years Dr. Nicholson was a professor at MD Anderson Clinic in Texas. At the present time, he's with the Institute of Molecular Medicine in Southern California. He is the editor of a number of scientific journals. He is the author of well over 500 peer-reviewed scientific articles, which I've checked out, and believe me, they're very, very real. We're fortunate to have Dr. Nicholson with us this evening. He's done a great deal of work on the Gulf War illness and certainly contributed greatly to my understanding of many of the illnesses that plague modern-day America, which really are poorly understood, but are based upon chronic infections and the body's reaction to it. Dr. Nicholson, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Well, it's, again, a pleasure being with you.
Well, now, of course, you'd faxed me something in the mail about protection from bioterror and biological warfare agents, and fascinating to contemplate. Did you want to talk about that this evening? What do you think is the message you'd like to get out to our listeners?
Well, I think first, although these agents are out there, we know that quite readily from what's happened in the past year, I don't think we should panic just because there's the possibility of a biowarfare attack. What we need to know is information about these agents and how to protect yourself against these agents and what to do if an attack occurs.
I agree with you totally. One of the things is that apparently the anthrax attack, which we'd seen coming on just about a week or so after 9/11 last year, apparently was from our own supplies. In other words, they're investigating people who work for our government. Certainly, I don't think Saddam Hussein has the ability to militarize anthrax to the degree that that this attack was. This attack, certainly a terrible, terrible tragedy with 13 infections and 5 deaths, but it appeared to originate not from foreign sources, but from domestic sources, which is even perhaps more frightening to think that there are people in America, Americans, who would do such a thing to fellow Americans.
Well, it's interesting that the genetic signature of the type of anthrax that was found, for example, in the letters sent to the U.S. Congress, to the U.S. Senate, were of the type that has been developed domestically as a biological warfare agent. There's some other characteristics as well, the types of wetting agents that were used and drying agents in the preparation of the anthrax spores, as well as their small clusters. They were milled down to very small size to permit their entry deep into the lungs when they were inhaled. All of that really smacks as a domestic product. We know that the technology that's used in the production of biological warfare agents, and in this case it was a technology that essentially is the same as the technology that was developed in the United States. The former Soviet Union used a slightly different technology, and they used different strains of anthrax and so on. And their collaborators, let's say, or their nations that went along with their program, Iran, Iraq, other nations, North Korea, and so on, generally used the Soviet process for production of anthrax. So I think it's extremely unlikely that the anthrax source was foreign. I think it was domestic, and I think that the reason we haven't heard much information on it is that they do by now have the genetic sequence, entire genetic sequence of the anthrax that was used, and I would imagine that it's a domestic anthrax. We know the strain was the Ames strain, which is a domestic strain, and they know that from immunologic typing. But when we get the genetic information, we'll probably know what laboratory it came from.
Well, I'm sure we will. And I think that, you know, what I think the most important message is, there really are evil people out there in the world. And, of course, right now the administration is focusing attention on Iraq. They were involved in 9/11, and so that's why we're going to go to war with them. My concern is that we're looking for all sorts of excuses to go to war with Iraq. And, of course, you know, they couldn't blame the anthrax attack on them. So now they're trying to say that somehow Osama bin Laden and these 15 Saudi Arabians were working with the Al-Qaeda. Well, be that as it may, but what about the threat to America? Is it a real threat, or are we just being frightened to death in an effort to rally the people behind our leaders And of course, sometimes we've seen throughout the years how politicians and leaders will use a perceived external threat to increase their control over the lives of their populace.
Well, I certainly agree with that, and we shouldn't jump to conclusions, I think, about any of this until we have further information, particularly when it comes to the biological warfare agents that we now know were used on U.S. soil. Everything points to a domestic source, and that's what we should pursue doggedly. We, as you know, we've been working with the FBI and the Secret Service on this problem, and we pointed out very early on the high likelihood that this was a domestic source, and that's where they need to be spending their energies. And I think initially they scoffed at us, but as time went on and more information became available, they realized the same conclusion.
All right, fine. Well, now what about some of the other problems? In the message you sent me and the paper you sent me, you talk about all the other potential sources of biological warfare agents. Should we really be concerned about the threat of smallpox? I mean, we've told for so many years there wasn't any smallpox, and then suddenly now we're talking about the threat of smallpox, how everybody's going to have to be forcefully vaccinated. In fact, the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act that is being enacted all across the nation will make it, at least according to the original draft, a serious offense, a misdemeanor, to refuse to be vaccinated, which could result in either prison or fining people or their isolation or quarantine if they refuse to be isolated. I could see how that could be misused. Certainly there's a place for isolation of people who've been in contact with diseases like Ebola or Marburg or Lassa, some of these other diseases. But, my concern is, will public health authorities always act responsibly?
Well, of course, that's a question which I think we're struggling with. We've tried to organize public health in a way that it can respond to these, and I think that they've at least made an attempt in the last 6 months to a year in terms of training, in terms of organization, in terms of stockpiling things like antibiotics for emergency use and so on. So I think that there is an attempt to do something in this area, and I think that the information is out there. It perhaps needs to be more widely disseminated. But there is quite a bit of information available now.
Well, certainly I think that the dissemination of antibiotics would be so vitally important, but it should be in every community. The idea that, you know, we're going to have a major problem in San Francisco, so we're going to ship antibiotics from somewhere in the Midwest to San Francisco with a major epidemic there. I don't know who's going to want to take the antibiotics in.
Well, I think that they can't really provide stockpiles in every city for something like this. They have to understand that if an attack occurs, it's most likely going to be localized in one area. So they need to get things like antibiotics, if it's a bacterial weapon, to the area as quickly as possible. So they need regions, and they need to base those regional depots more or less on where the population is distributed and where the risk is distributed. Now, the risk is probably higher in urban areas than it is in rural areas, so you need to probably position them as much closely as possible to urban sites that might be at higher risk. And so, you know, they've probably considered a number of these things. I mean, this is not really rocket science, it's common sense. So I think that we're now better prepared, certainly, than we were a year or so ago if we face a really large attack. Now, you mentioned smallpox, and I think that there is a danger in smallpox because people were previously immunized at my age and your age. I mean, we all had our smallpox immunizations when we were young and growing up, but basically that program was stopped years ago because essentially smallpox was eradicated from the planet. But there's still the risk that this could be stockpiled and released by a terrorist. And it could cause havoc because most of the population now really has no immunity against smallpox. And particularly if it's a weaponized smallpox, that means that it's more virulent and it also may be immunologically different from the smallpox that was used to vaccinate individuals years ago, meaning that people would not have immunity against it. This could cause a lot of problems.
Well, now where would it come from? Certainly, I can't imagine Saddam Hussein producing something like that. I can't imagine the Ayatollahs over there in Iran producing that, or the North Koreans producing that. So the only places really that they have the capacity would be the United States, Great Britain, and Russia. And supposedly Russia is our great friend. In fact, we're giving it all sorts of money. So where is this going to come from? You know, if we're going to create genetic new forms of smallpox, and then, of course, weaponize that, which I would think would be, you know, require very, very sophisticated equipment. I mean, where is it going to come from realistically?
Well, this is the first time I'm going to disagree with you on any point that we've ever discussed over the years.
That's all right. I mean, I sometimes frame these questions because I want your response.
Well, in fact, Iraq, Iran, and North Korea, and probably other countries as well, do have the capacity to produce these things.
Oh, no, I mean a genetically altered type of the smallpox?
Yes, because they can get that, for example, from the former Soviet Union, from the laboratories there and the individuals there that worked in those programs. You know, one of the things that we tried to do after the fall of the Soviet Union was to contribute a certain amount of money to keep their biological warfare program intact. Not necessarily to keep producing biologic agents, but to keep the workers, the scientists, the engineers, and so on in Russia, and not have them go off to Iraq and Iran and other places and essentially sell their experience and their expertise to a foreign power to use in their program. So I think some of this has probably happened. I don't know how extensive it is, but it's been very difficult to keep track of all these people, and a lot of them have just disappeared, and so we don't know what's happened to them. We've tried to keep those kinds of programs going, but it's extremely difficult, and also there's now a certain amount of secrecy in Russia itself, even within these areas that supposedly we opened up to inspection and opened up by giving them money. Now all of a sudden they've contracted a bit and they're being secretive again. So we really don't know what has happened. We don't have any idea if any of these agents have gotten loose in terms of being shipped to foreign powers. And they had a massive biological warfare program that was going on for decades and decades, producing huge quantities of biologic agents. And so we haven't accounted for all those biologic agents. And we have no idea where all of them went.
You know, one of the things that has always disturbed me is the fact that back, I guess, in the early 70s, they discontinued the smallpox vaccine, guaranteeing us there was no more threat of smallpox. And I thought that was the dumbest thing in the entire world. And then, of course, because of the attitude in Washington, D.C. and within the public health circles, you couldn't get smallpox vaccine if you wanted to vaccinate yourself and your family. And so, really, they did everything they could, perhaps altruistically, although I always question sometimes the things that come out of our Washington, D.C., to keep people from getting vaccinated if they wanted to get vaccinated for smallpox. And to this very day, they're saying, yeah, we're going to decide whether or not you're going to get the smallpox vaccine or not. And these things disturb me. I would think that people should have the right, if they want to take the vaccine, to take it. If they don't want to take the vaccine, not to take it. But the idea that you're going to force people either not to take it or to take it because of the central planning, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I, like you, I'm a little bit disturbed by some of the directives that have come out of Washington about some of these very important issues. And yes, I'm a strong believer in freedom of choice. And there's also the other side of the story, which involves the anthrax vaccine, that people should have the freedom of choice to reject that vaccine because it's not a good vaccine. And we've written several professional articles on that vaccine, and we've summarized the problems that are associated with the vaccine and why it's not a good vaccine and why the people that make it have had a very poor record, and there's really questions about its efficacy, there are questions about its safety, and these are all very legitimate questions, and that's why I was very pleased that, for example, the U.S. Postal Service decided to go with prophylactic antibiotics, not the anthrax vaccine, when there was a risk that postal workers might come down with cutaneous or inhalation anthrax.
Well, I'm certainly glad that is as well. In fact, I don't know of any real studies that show that this is really effective by itself against inhalation anthrax. I know that they did some monkey studies where they took 10 monkeys, and this was before the Gulf War, and they gave them pulmonary anthrax and vaccinated them, and you know, 8 of the 10 monkeys died. That isn't a very good commentary on the vaccine. Is there any studies that show that this vaccine will protect people against pulmonary anthrax without concomitant antibiotics?
Not to my knowledge. There's quite a dearth of information available in terms of clinical information on the anthrax vaccine and on its ability to protect. The only information that's really available is primarily for cutaneous anthrax, and that comes from the wool industry, for example, where the anthrax vaccine that's currently used was originally developed. So that anthrax vaccine was originally developed for another use, to prevent cutaneous anthrax infections. It was not developed for inhalation or pulmonary anthrax, which is the way it's delivered as a biological warfare agent. So it was never really developed for the type of biological warfare threats that we're facing. It was developed really for an industrial problem that they had with cutaneous anthrax. So I really don't think that it's ever really been adequately tested. I know that the vaccine itself has been changed several times over the years. It was originally approved by the Division of Biologics at the National Institutes of Health. It was never approved by the FDA, even though they claim it was. The manufacturing process has been changed several times since the original approval, and by law, it should have been reassessed by the FDA, and it, to my knowledge, it never was. So there are lots of problems with this vaccine, and I'm very much against its use in our armed forces personnel without proper informed consent.
Well, we had a Colonel Tom Hiemstra, who's written the book Anthrax, A Shot in the Dark, or A Dangerous Shot in the Dark. Anyway, we interviewed him this past week, and he's written a book. That's the title of the book. And he points out that, you know, of course, they've pretty well stopped forcing this on the pilots, because so many of the pilots just said they were going to quit the military and we weren't going to have an Air Force, an effective one. They were talking about losing several thousand pilots. They don't have that many to lose. And so apparently they're only going to be giving it to military personnel going overseas for more than 2 weeks at a time. But apparently they've got pretty good supplies of it now, so they're beginning to talk about stockpiling it to give to civilians in case of an anthrax attack. And that is a frightening thing to me. I certainly would not want to take that vaccine, knowing its track record, knowing the number of deaths that have occurred. And now even the FDA apparently has put something into the package insert that says, what is it, about 11% of the people will have adverse reactions and some of them die?
Yes, and you see that's changed quite a bit from the insert that was in the package. For example, when it was used, those same vaccine was used during the Gulf War. And we know, for example, during the Gulf War from studies, from epidemiologic studies conducted after the war, and there are at least a couple studies in England now, and I know of one good one in the United States on veterans from the state of Kansas that points to the multiple vaccines given during deployment as highly associated with Gulf War illness. In fact, the associations were that if you were deployed and received the multiple vaccines, you had the highest risk for Gulf War illness. Next in line was if you received the multiple vaccines and were not deployed, you were at intermediate risk, and you were at lower risk if you were deployed and didn't get the vaccines.
Well, now, when you speak of vaccines, we know they were using the anthrax, at least about 150,000 of them, is my understanding. And then, but there weren't that many that got the botulism vaccine. What other vaccines were they getting? Is it multiple vaccines that led to the problem?
Well, most of them got multiple vaccines, 20 to 25 different vaccines, or vaccinations at least, within usually a three-day period or a three- or four-day period during deployment. The problem is that we don't know who got what, because they've classified the shot records, and at one point they claimed that 400,000 shot records disappeared.
I don't believe that.
I don't believe that either. They know exactly who got what because they were entering it in the medical records. They just were not allowing individuals to have their shot records and carry them with them with that information entered into the records. although we have gotten a few, for example, nurses that managed to sneak out a few of the records so that we have an idea what was given. And there were a lot of routine vaccines given, but there were also a couple of experimental vaccines given, and we have absolutely no idea what the experimental vaccines were and what they contained.
Well, now that is frightening because, of course, there are laws against using experimental vaccines on people without their, informed consent. And it would appear that the people in the government just ignore the laws of the land.
Well, that's certainly true, and that's there's a history of that in the armed forces. I mean, starting with the atomic veterans and, of course, the Agent Orange story and so on. So there's a very rich history of the medical corps of the Navy and the Army going ahead and doing experiments on armed forces personnel without informed consent or even without their knowledge. And it's unfortunate, but it's been occurring for a long time. We've actually, some of our patients that have come to us for assistance, for example, we have a group of former Marines who were entered into or volunteered into medical experiments after their basic training. And these people are now have been totally incapacitated since their service in the Marines. And it's interesting that one of the physicians who was involved in these experiments without any informed consent, where a lot of these Marine recruits actually died during the experiments, is none other than the chief civilian in the Pentagon who's in charge of the Gulf War illness research. And he was a former Navy captain who was in charge, in the Gulf War illness program, was assistant to Rotzker, who was head of the program at the time. So, you have people like this that have been involved in this their entire careers, and they're the ones making the judgments on the care of our armed forces personnel. Come on, I don't buy it.
Do you have any idea what they were doing with these Marines, what sort of a bizarre experiments they were doing with these Marines?
Well, we know in a few cases, because where the medical records could be recovered in the case of one or two Marines that we've worked with because they went to their congressman, their local congressman, to get help. And first, the Marine Corps denied they were ever in the Marines, and they denied they were patients. Well, eventually they found their records. Yes, they were in the Marines. Yes, they were patients, and they received medical boards releasing them from their service and so on. And in this case, they were able to recover the records, and they actually showed the programs that they were in. They were coded. And one of these guys is a computer expert, and he slowly but surely broke down the code and figured out that he was in an experimental program to test biological and radiological agents, and again, without any informed consent. And this particular person, his physician at the time at Balboa Naval Hospital, was none other than Michael Kilpatrick, who's now the head civilian in the Pentagon that deals with Gulf War illness.
Well, now, of course, are these boys getting any compensation at all, or have they simply been abandoned?
No, they've been abandoned. They've gotten absolutely no compensation. As I said, for quite a while, the government was denying that they were even in the armed forces.
How is this any different than what the Nazis did in the concentration camps? Of course, they were, didn't have the ability to move around. But certainly, when you're in the military, you don't have much freedom either. And, of course, to do these grotesque experiments, isn't this really a violation of the Nuremberg Protocols?
Oh, absolutely it is. And I firmly believe that this is one of the major reasons why the United States is against the world court. They don't want to subject certain senior, leadership within the armed forces and the government to potential legal liability. If somebody went to the world court and said, look, this was illegal, there's a strong history of this, a rich history from the Nuremberg trials on, showing that this is illegal, you cannot use prisoners or armed forces personnel for illegal experiments, and if you do, those people that did it are criminals and need to be brought to justice.
Well, I really think that the tragedy is that most Americans find it difficult to believe that this thing goes on in America. But if you're out there and you question at all, we have a report called the Rockefeller Report. It actually came out of the Veterans Administration back in 1994, and if you'd like to know how to get it, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And, of course, that's a lot of things that has happened in the past, in 1994 and before. But I'm sure this sort of thing has gone on for a long period of time.
It has. And if people, for example, want information about the anthrax vaccine, which is a very timely thing, They want information about biologic warfare agents, for example, about chronic illnesses in general. They can go to our website, which is www.immed.org. Just think of immediate.org, and you'll find your way to the website. And there are lots of medical and scientific articles that from the peer-reviewed literature that you can download from our website and look at that data yourself. Look at that information to make up your own mind.
And let me recommend that too, ladies and gentlemen. That's IMMED. Is that .com?
.org.
.org. IMMED.org. And go there and get the information and find out what's going on and find out about these vaccines, because they are going to tell you that they have the power and you don't want to be a criminal by refusing to take what they want to give you. But with the record sets that they have, do you really want to subject yourself and your family? You better get informed now, because the time may come when you're going to have to make a decision, and you want to know what you're actually making that decision based upon. Now, one of the interesting things that I read in the material you sent me, you mentioned, of course, that some of the people came home from the Gulf War illness and they had a mycoplasma infection. You also mentioned that some of them had a brucellosis infection or a chronic brucellosis infection. Would you like to go into that? Because I didn't realize that there, did I misunderstand you, or was there some of our boys that did have a chronic brucellosis infection?
Yes, we actually found some. We haven't really looked at large numbers, but we do know that there was an incidence of brucella infections in the Gulf War veterans. So we think that that's, you know, potentially one of the problems that they faced. There were some, for example, that had another infection called Q fever, caused by a bacterium called Coxiella. And so these agents, brucella, Q fever, we feel also mycoplasma, are considered incapacitating biologic warfare agents if they've been weaponized. Now, what does that mean? Well, if they're weaponized, that means that they're designed, they've been engineered to be able to use as an aerosol out in the field somewhere to infect large numbers of people, or in some cases animals if they're directed against livestock, and infect them with an agent that will cause a chronic illness. That's why they're called incapacitating. So they're not lethal. The idea is to incapacitate an individual to make them chronically ill so they can't perform their duties, and so it takes other individuals to take care of them, nurses, doctors, healthcare professionals, and so on. So it puts a strain on the healthcare system, and these people are no longer performing their duties, but they're still eating food, they're still collecting their salaries and whatever. So the idea there is to overwhelm a healthcare system, causing so much chronic illness that it's a burden. It's an economic and social burden on society. I think in a way that these types of agents in the long run are more dangerous than the acute agents like anthrax and smallpox, because in a way those are so frightening and they're so quick that they're almost self-limiting. When you have an attack, something like anthrax, for example, it's more or less self-limiting because it's not very contagious, even the weaponized versions of anthrax. So the people who are exposed may come down and become sick and may even die if they didn't get antibiotics quickly enough or didn't have some way of protection like passive immunization quickly enough. But it's not going to penetrate further into the population like these chronic agents are doing right now.
And they really are spreading throughout the population. This is the frightening thing, and many times the wives and the children get these diseases as well, but you're not hearing about it. Well, we're going to have to take a three-minute break, and when we get back, why, we'll welcome your calls at 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and if you're out there listening to us and you believe that this information needs to be gotten out across the country, that there really are problems that you're not hearing about from Barbara Walters or Dan Rather or Tom Brokaw, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. Some people would like to help with what we're doing, and of course we'd love to have you consider joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. If you would like a copy of our latest newsletter, which deals with the overall subject of vaccinations, because we want you educated as to the history of vaccines, their use in America. Most people believe that vaccines have caused a dramatic decline in the overall death rate. People live longer than today than they did before, which is really very true. Well, I think you'll be surprised when you read the mortality statistics for the 20th century, starting with the year 1901. Anyway, if you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. I think you'll find some fascinating material there. And then let me just mention our website, radioliberty.com, and you can pull down our newsletters, which cover many, many subjects. Our newsletter on the vaccines, in fact, my last three newsletters have all dealt with the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act, and why I am concerned when somebody is going to make it a crime if you refuse to be vaccinated or allow your family to be vaccinated. And the problem is that there's a pretty poor track record under certain circumstances on some of the things that have been mandated for the children of this country. So at least read the material there, and of course it's all documented. You can tell where the source material came from. If you can't find it, you can always call us and we'll send it to you. But get the information, because of course the life you save could be that of someone you love or yourself. Again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927, our website, radioliberty.com, and please tell others about our programs, tell them about our website, and help us get the truth out across America, from sea to shining sea. Well, Dr. Stan back here, I guess, this evening, Dr. Garth Nicholson from the Institute on Molecular Medicine. And if you're out there across America and you'd like to give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, please, we'd love to hear from you. Again, 464-8295, or out across America at 888-24-LIBERTY. And, of course, here we send 700,000 of our young men overseas to fight Saddam Hussein. Because, of course, he's invaded Kuwait, and certainly tremendous support for this war on the part of the American people. But, of course, we have an awful lot of our young men who've come home and been very, very ill. Do we have any idea how many of our fighting men, of our servicemen, of the 700,000 we sent over, or perhaps weren't deployed but did take the vaccine, how many of them do we have any idea have either died or become very ill?
Well, we know that over 150,000 have become ill, because this is the number that has registered either with the Department of Defense or the Department of Veterans Affairs. That does not include immediate family members, and there's one U.S. Senate study indicating that 77% of spouses and 65% of children born after the war are showing similar signs and symptoms to the veterans.
That was the Riegel report, wasn't it, Senator Riegel's report?
Yes, those were staffers actually that were in the Riegel committee who actually put together the report and did the survey on 1,200 families. That's never been followed up. In fact, the only thing that has come out is an official denial from the VA that the family members have gotten sick. And I know how this can occur, because I've talked to these families, because we did our own little family study to see in the families that are sick whether they had the same kinds of problems, health problems, that the veterans had. And I'll get to that in just a moment, but just to show you how they've skewed the results, practically every family that was in our study, what happened when they went to the VA is the VA just denied that family members were sick, even though the family members had essentially the same signs and symptoms as the veteran. The laboratory tests were the same, but yet they denied that they were sick. So there was just more or less an order that was put out, don't diagnose any family members with Gulf War illness. And I think that's tragic, because what's happened is that in one case, one of the infections that we found due to Mycoplasma fermentans in about 40% of the Gulf War veterans, this infection is spread to spouses, and then it's spread to the children. And so we have a lot of family members who are sick now, again, exhibiting the same signs and symptoms as we documented in a recent paper in the Journal of Chronic Fatigue Syndrome, and they have the same infection as well. They have the same Mycoplasma fermentans infection, and it at an alarmingly high rate compared to, you know, their siblings who are not sick, for example, and the children, or other families where there's no evidence of illness, or even families where there's some evidence of illness, but it's not the same illness. So we have a problem here. Because we didn't acknowledge that, I think it's penetrated further into the population than we would even expect. So I think this is a sleeper that's going to come back to bite us. By failing to do anything about this problem, we have absolutely ensured that it will continue to penetrate into our population and cause chronic illness. And we've seen an alarming increase in chronic illness in the last few years of all sorts. Chronic autoimmune diseases like rheumatoid arthritis, for example, MS, even ALS, which we talked about in one of the previous shows. And again, we found that 90% of the ALS cases and 100% of the Gulf War veterans with ALS had this same type of unusual bacteria, this mycoplasma. So this is something that may not necessarily cause the illness, but it's an important aspect of the illness that needs to be better understood, not ignored. And right now, there's a lot of ignorance, and I think there's also a lot of just simply ignoring the problem and hoping that it will go away. And this is a problem that won't go away, because once you get these chronic infections into the population, if you don't treat them and adequately control them, they will continue to be passed individual to individual until essentially we're going to have a catastrophe on our hands.
Well, of course, we're seeing this sort of a catastrophe in Africa with the AIDS epidemic over there. I mean, you go into Botswana, 50% of the women from 20 to 35 years of age, 50% of them who've been tested in Botswana, which is a very prosperous black country, or was, are now infected with HIV, and we can anticipate they're going to die because they die very rapidly. Now, in the United States, apparently almost everybody who has HIV infection also has mycoplasma. Why is that? I mean, what's the interrelationship? Because it appears that there is a cofactor, and of course I'm shifting a little from these chronic illnesses into AIDS, but this has always been one of my fascinations, morbid fascination, admittedly, but trying to understand this. Certainly we know that Luc Montagnier, who originally identified the HIV virus, it said that mycoplasma was a cofactor. Robert Gallo said it was hepatitis 6, I think, virus 6. But there appears to be several factors other than just the HIV by itself. What is your take on that?
Well, I think it's these other factors that actually cause the morbidity or cause the sickness rather than the HIV itself. The HIV may set you up for either opportunistic infections or allow infections that are co-infections to get out of control. And another example would be Lyme disease, where we know it's not just one infection. The primary infection is a spirochete called Borrelia, but Borrelia goes along with mycoplasma in that case as well, because we in another laboratory in New Jersey that have been studying this process find that 70% of the people have both infections, both a mycoplasma and a Borrelia infection at the same time. And although we've done a little bit of study in this area, the laboratory in New Jersey is studied extensively the ticks that actually pass the disease from infected animals, for example, to people, and they found that the ticks are carrying all these infections, not only the Borrelia and the mycoplasma, but other bacteria like Ehrlichia and Babesia and other infectious forms, and they're just little bags of infection. So that's how some of these infections get passed. They get passed as multiple co-infections, not as single infections. And I think that's alarming, because you have these multiple agents, all of them very difficult actually to find and diagnose properly, and very difficult to treat, since with multiple agents, it's always more difficult to effectively treat them than if you have a single agent. So this really complicates the whole strategy of dealing with this. And of course, I think we're dealing very poorly with Lyme disease right now. Not only are we dealing with it poorly in terms of diagnosing it and failing to diagnose the co-infections that go along with it, but we're doing very poorly in terms of treatment strategies as well. Very few people know how to deal with this problem.
Well, you know, is Lyme disease primarily a spirochetal infection? Is it primarily a combined infection of spirochete and mycoplasm? Or is it a spectrum of diseases involving multiple infections?
Well, I think it's probably the latter. I think that these are overlapping disease states, more or less involving multiple co-infections. And unfortunately, in a lot of these multiple co-infections cause fairly non-specific signs and symptoms, so it's kind of difficult to say, does a person have Lyme disease, or do they have chronic fatigue syndrome, or if they have painful muscles and sore areas, do they have fibromyalgia syndrome, or if they have sore joints, for example, and loss of joint mobility, they have rheumatoid arthritis. Well, they could have all of those diagnoses at once if you examine them very carefully, because of the nature of these types of infections. They're systemic. They go throughout the body. Different individuals will tend to have different types of problems depending upon their susceptibilities and genetic weaknesses and so on. So I think we have a terrible problem on our hands, and I think the way we're dealing with it is completely inadequate.
Well, when I went to medical school, I never heard of Lyme disease. Now, is this a new disease, or is it a disease we've just suddenly recognized? In other words, we seem to be seeing all sorts of new diseases that never existed before. I mean, we never saw AIDS before. I mean, AIDS is a new disease. This chronic fatigue is a new disease. A pathological mycoplasm appears to be a new disease. Lyme is a new disease. Where did all these diseases come from?
Well, it's all very suspicious, and we could get involved in a lot of speculation about the origin, whether, you know, these were biological warfare experiments that got out of control and all this. There's a lot of speculation on this, but I think even putting that aside, I think some of that speculation is probably pretty accurate, although it's very difficult to prove. The point is that what do you do about it? Do you just continue to ignore it? And maybe there was an experimental mistake, for example, like the killer bee situation that got loose in Brazil and has caused a catastrophe. I'm sure that things like this have happened, but do you just pretend they didn't happen and ignore it, or do you admit it and do something about it?
Well, this is the thing. Well, right now we've got Robin calling from Carmel, but when we after Robin, I really want to get an approach, because I think this is the most important thing. We're stuck with where we are. We can't go back in time. The time machine really has not been fully developed, and probably never will be. So where do we go from here? But right now, Robin, hi, Robin. You're calling from Carmel?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say that I have been reading Dr. Atkins. Are you familiar with him?
Yes, I am. Very familiar with him.
Now, who is Dr. Atkins? You're going to have to fill me in.
Okay. Dr. Robert Atkins, he works, and I believe the terminology is complementary medicine, but he is a physician, and he uses a lot of vitamin therapy.
Now, that is not the Dr. Atkins of the Atkins diet, is it?
That's the same one.
Okay, fine. Well, what was the point you wanted to make there?
Well, I just got a book of his, and the copyright date is 98, so it's fairly recent. It's called Dr. Atkins' Vita Nutrient Solution.
All right.
And I've been reading, and he mentions a lot of these diseases you've been talking about tonight and how to treat them with vitamins.
All right, fine. Well, what are your thoughts on that, Dr. Nicholson?
Well, I think this is one part of the equation. It's not the only part. In fact, if you'll read his more recent books, you'll see that he actually acknowledges the fact that chronic infections are widespread, and we really have not really thought about this or dealt with this problem and so on. So he does know about it. You know, there's a lot of things that I know about that I can't talk about concerning this particular individual, but he does know about it, and I think part of his solutions are very good. One of the things that he was one of the first to recommend, which I completely agree with, and we put out in our own recommendations on our website, and if you call us up at the Institute for Molecular Medicine,
yeah,
is that people that have chronic illnesses need to get off all processed sugar.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is that sugar is very damaging to your immune system.
Yeah.
It is very damaging to you if you have these chronic infections, because it actually feeds the infection, and that's something you don't want to do. So one of the important recommendations, and we have about 20 different general recommendations, and that's just one of them, but I very much agree with Dr. Atkins in this issue, is you need to get away from processed sugar as much as possible and get back to a more natural diet.
And you do have a section up there on your webpage about how we can increase our own immunity, because that's really the sort of the key to the whole thing, isn't it?
Oh, yes, absolutely. In fact, if you go on our website and go under treatment considerations on our website, there are at least two documents on diet alone that you can download. These are publications that discuss the dietary aspects of treatment of disease. One of these documents was written by myself and a colleague in Zimbabwe who's dealing head-on with the AIDS crisis down there. He has about six clinics, which we help support, that are affiliated with the Institute for Molecular Medicine. And they deal, almost 80% of the patients have AIDS, and they deal with this problem. And we found in our clinical trials down there in Zimbabwe that diet is absolutely essential. You have to deal with these dietary issues, or the patients will never get better. So you have to start with diet, and I think that's a very important point that is overlooked in mainstream medicine, is the importance of diet in the health of an individual who has any type of illness, whether it be chronic or any other type of illness. It is important, and we have to make adjustments to our lifestyle, to our diet, and this needs to be done irrespective of the rest of the type of therapy that one is receiving.
All right. Anything else you want to say, Robin?
That was it.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your call. It's good to know that you're picking us up there in Carmel.
Bye-bye.
Bye. All right. Fine. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question or comment, our telephone number, 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. And, of course, one of the great tragedies of today is Zimbabwe is facing starvation there. Talk about nutrition. If things continue as they are, because Mugabe has actually forced the white farmers off their farms just at the time when they'd ordinarily begin cultivating and planting crops. No crops, no food, mass starvation. And here's a nation where 25-30% of the adult population is infected with HIV. And, of course, without adequate nutrition, why they will die even more rapidly. Well, what are some of the other things that people can do dealing with these chronic diseases? And you've named them. You've named Brucella, and you've named certainly the Lyme disease, and these other diseases go along with that. But before we perhaps get to that, what is the place of antibiotics in the treatment of mycoplasma and Lyme disease and the other diseases we've talked about? Are they a helpful adjunct?
Well, we feel that they are, and we've always recommended their use depending upon what types of infections are present, mainly because the types of infections that we deal with just cannot be dealt with directly with non-traditional or alternative means of medicine. And believe me, I'm all for it. As a matter of fact, one of my titles is a professor of integrative medicine, and that means you integrate the mainstream medicine with the non-mainstream medicine, or the alternative with the mainstream medicine. And so I'm a big fan of a lot of things in alternative medicine. But one thing is for sure, when you really have a very nasty chronic infection, it's probably not enough. You have to go to a bigger hammer. And in the case of bacterial infections, the bigger hammer is the appropriate antibiotics. And they have to be used correctly, and they have to be used along with friendly bacteria called probiotics to reestablish the gut flora, because things like antibiotics take a heavy toll on the gut when you take them, particularly if you take them long-term, which is often required for these chronic infections. So we do recommend a lot of supplementation with the friendly bacteria or probiotic bacteria. We also recommend things like immune enhancement products, and without getting into the specifics of that, there's all kinds of information out there. For example, you can go to a website called immunesupport.com. There's information on the World Wide Web, tremendous amount of information on immune enhancement and boosting your own cellular immune systems to deal with these chronic infections. And I think it's an important adjunct to the more traditional approach of antibiotics. And it's certainly what we recommend when somebody gets off antibiotics, to continue these types of programs to keep your immune system posed to prevent superinfection, or to keep any infection that you've had fully suppressed, because many of these infections you never get rid of. You probably have them for life. They're probably there hiding deep in your tissues, and maybe you can hold them in check. But as we found with many patients, if they then, let's say, get in an automobile accident or have some sort of severe trauma, which can artificially suppress or temporarily suppress your immune system, and then, bam, these infections crop up again, and then people a few weeks later have all the symptoms of chronic fatigue syndrome or whatever they had before that they thought they got rid of.
All right, fine. Well, is there any place for things like garlic or oil of oregano or things of that sort?
Oh, I think so. Unfortunately, it's kind of an individual thing, so patients have to kind of shop around and try a number of these immune enhancement products and see what works for them. Everyone's immune system seems to be a bit different. I think the important primary things are that we have to have the right vitamins and minerals and foods. And so we have some recommendations on that if you look on our website. But that's just the beginning. And then from there, diet is essential. Other aspects of diet, these probiotics that I mentioned.
Now, what is a probiotic you're speaking of? Are you speaking of to replenish the bacteria in the gut?
Yes. These are what we call friendly bacteria, or the public knows them as friendly bacteria. Our gut contains quite a bit of bacteria, kilograms worth of bacteria that help us digest food. And if we kill all those bacteria off, we don't really digest food very well, and we have all kinds of other gut-associated problems. And so to maintain the flora in the gut, you have to keep replacing it if you're taking antibiotics.
All right, fine. So then, of course, diet, vitamins, some of these things, echinacea, I suppose, garlic. And you've got a whole list of these various things up there on your website?
Yes, we do. We have a list of things that have proven to be effective. Now, how effective really depends on the individual. So it's something that an individual would have to try. And a lot of people are trying various combinations of different things. And, I wish there was a protocol that everyone could use. It would be a miracle protocol, but it just doesn't exist. So you have to kind of try these and see how they work for you.
All right. Well, let's go to Theodore. And I know Theodore is calling from Santa Cruz. Hi. How are you, Theodore?
Hi, Dr. Stan. And hi, Dr. Nicholson. And I want to tell you, I'm inveterate networker around health issues, and yours is the website I give out the most.
Are you really? Well, yeah, that's great.
Well, I appreciate that very much.
Truly, I honor you completely, and I cannot give you enough credit for giving people who are caught with these diseases and also caught into the they need a doctor to tell them that there's another direction. Because a lot of I don't go to doctors, so I'm very healthy. But I am very glad to tell my friends who do go to doctors that you are somebody out there who is a beacon. And thank you, thank you, thank you. And I hope you're keeping yourself very healthy.
Well, thank you, Theodore. Anything else you want to
say? Yeah, one of the issues I'm concerned about more recently is, and I'm very well of how we're being attacked with these mycoplasmic invaders. But I'm working on the issue of cell towers and cell antenna and cell phones, and I'm becoming very aware of the microwave assault on our bodies. So I'm wondering if you have, if that's an area you've looked into yet or have any information on how we can keep healthier.
All right, let's ask. Everybody I see has a cell phone, and I even use one, but very, very rarely. What about, the portable electronic phones, the things of that sort? Are we really in any jeopardy at all because we seem to be surrounded by these electronic waves?
Well, I just don't know. I mean, these are things that people have suggested could be a problem. I think that this is an area that needs to be more thoroughly explored. And unfortunately, it's extremely difficult, for example, to get the government interested in doing very carefully controlled studies on these sorts of things to find out if there's any danger in using these things long-term or not. There's certainly no short-term danger, but what we're talking about is prolonged long-term use of things like cell phones or whatever. And does that result in a problem, a health problem? And I don't think there's really an answer for that right now, and it's unfortunate.
I want to encourage you to keep open on that, because just like you're a pioneer in helping us understand that we're under attack from these mycoplasmic infections that don't register as infections, and we need to go through all kinds of jump through all kinds of hoops to actually find out that we're dealing with infections and it's legitimate. You're the pioneer there. There are people just like you working on this issue about, you know, what happens to the human body when it's in and trees and animals. What happens when we're more and more inundated with the microwave radiation that is part of the cell technology? And it's already known that we're bioreactive with this, with these wavelengths. So, yes, but more importantly, thank you for taking responsibility for the piece that you're taking responsibility for.
You know, you can't do everything, Theodore. And,
no.
Dr. Nicholson, will tell you, if he doesn't know, he doesn't know. And maybe it'll turn out that your concerns are very real. I'll tell you what I'm concerned about it, too, but I'm not going to take a position until I have some scientific backing.
Well, in honor of your program and in honor of Dr. Garth Nicholson's work, let me remind everybody, question authority. So thank you both.
And the truth is out there. Bye-bye.
Yes.
Okay, fine. That was Theodore. And Theodore is a very active and very nice lady living right here in Santa Cruz. Well, we're going to have, of course, to say goodbye to our listeners up there in the great state of Washington and Oregon and Idaho. Would you like to get your website and your telephone number out? Because we'll have a different audience this next hour. But let's tell them how to get in touch with you if they'd like to.
Sure, they can access our website at any time. It's www.immed.org. Just think of immediate.org. They can write to us at the Institute for Molecular Medicine. We're in Huntington Beach on Triton Lane. They can call us at 714-903-2900. That's 714-903-2900. If you don't have access to the World Wide Web, gee, I thought everybody did, even in public libraries, you can call us.
Okay, fine. Well, thanks so very much. And just hang on. We're going to have to take a break here while we say goodnight to our listeners up in the great state of Washington. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, out across the world at 831-464-8295. That's 831-464-8295, or here in the Central Coast of California, it's 464-8295. But right now, well, you can call if you'd like to. Dr. Nicholson, you were mentioning that you're working with a doctor in Zimbabwe who has a number of clinics there treating the tragic victims of AIDS. And here, this is a situation, 25 to 30% of the adult population are HIV infected. I mean, it's just killing off the intellectuals, it's killing off the members of the cabinet, it's killing off the teachers, members of the military. Is the treatment there, is it helpful at all? Is there anything besides nutrition that can in any way influence the course of this disease?
Well, one thing that we've found at in the clinics in Zimbabwe, and there 40% of the people now are HIV positive, that if the diet is not corrected, these patients fail very quickly and die very quickly. If the diet is corrected, we can certainly prolong life. I can't say that anybody is cured by diet alone. That's really asking too much. But one thing is for certain, the people are stronger. They're better able to resist the effects of all the co-infections that are really causing the damage with HIV/AIDS.
All right, fine. By the co-infections, you're talking about the tuberculosis, you're talking about the all of the cryptosporosis and cryptococcus, or are you speaking of some of the other infections we've been talking about earlier?
Both, actually. But I think some of these infections, like the mycoplasmal infection, seem to go along with HIV, as you mentioned. Dr. Montagnier had proposed this many years ago, and I think he's very right on target with this, that there are co-infections that really cause the damage, that you can be HIV positive and have the HIV virus, and as long as you don't have these co-infections, you can be relatively healthy. But once you get the co-infections, then you start to fail very quickly.
All right, and Christian, now, as far as you're concerned, what about this idea of herpes 6? Is that a factor, or is that a herring, as it were, a red herring?
Well, we just don't know. I tend to believe that it's important. Why? Because we've found human herpes virus 6 in so many chronic diseases, and if you look, it's also a co-infection. In fact, we just published a study on this with chronic fatigue syndrome patients where we find it in about 30 to 35% of the patients. That's less than what we find with mycoplasmal infections, about 50% of the patients. But we also find other bacteria like chlamydia and other types of infections as well. So you put all this mix of these different infections together, and I guarantee you, you're not going to be well. And that seems to be the problem, is that it's hard to find a person with chronic fatigue syndrome or any of these other chronic illnesses that only have a single infection. They practically all of them have these multiple infections. And I think that all these infections, to a certain degree, take their toll. But any one infection alone may not. In fact, there are people walking around with any one of these infections. There's a certain percentage of our population that does not appear to be sick. They can have a single infection, and they can withstand it. But what is apparent when we do control studies is that we have yet to find anybody in a control group that has multiple infections. They can have a single infection, but they don't have multiple infections. So that's, I think, one of the things that distinguishes the disease state from the non-disease state.
Well, now, some people say candidiasis, intestinal candidiasis, plays a large part. Is that a factor?
Well, it's certainly a factor in many patients. In fact, it's fairly common in certain patients, and we know that these types of infections can really play havoc, and when they play havoc with our gut, then this really sets up an avenue for further infection. Whenever a person has a leaky gut syndrome, as it's called, then there are all kinds of infectious agents, bacteria, viruses, and so on, that can gain entry into our system, and therefore I think it's potentially very dangerous.
Well, what about these monkey cytomegalic viruses? Are they a factor?
We just don't know enough about that. I think any of these things could be potentially important in the context of other infections. That's why a lot of this is poo-pooed, because infectious disease specialists are so used to looking at one infection, one cause, one disease. Polio, polio virus causes polio. But, you know, that's very simplistic thinking, because if you look at the chronic illness patients, they all practically have these multiple co-infections. So you can't look at one infection and say, does this cause the disease or not? That's not the point. The important point is, if you have a bunch of these infections, does this overwhelm the person's immune system and cause morbidity?
Well, do you think that this these multiple chronic infections then is the basis for a lot of the people who have the chronic fatigue syndrome?
Well, yes, I do, along with other issues as well. It's not the only thing that's a problem. There are, for example, in certain parts of our country, in certain occupations and so on, chemical exposures, for example, that exacerbate these problems and so on. So in different patients, there seem to be different sets of problems that are really causing their illness. So there's no, you know, you can't point to any one single thing and say, aha, that causes all of the illness. It's more a combination of different things causes kind of unique illnesses in patients, but they have overlapping signs and symptoms with other patients.
And, of course, this is really, I think, what creates so much confusion, because, you know, we usually think of a stereotype, tuberculosis, a pulmonary disease, or can involve joints, of course, but primarily pulmonary disease, cavitation, you know, and so you treat the tuberculosis and the patient gets better. But the idea there could be all of these diseases out there. You know, and of course, one of the things we talked about a little bit earlier was this chronic brucellosis. Now, for our listeners out there, this is undulant fever. It was a disease that was known many years ago in cattle, and it was a problem. And don't they have that pretty well controlled in cattle by vaccinations?
Well, it is pretty much controlled, but we're finding more and more people, particularly in the Midwestern or Central United States, that have these infections and have a chronic fatigue syndrome-like disease. And so we know that these infections can pass, for example, from livestock to humans or human to human, and they cause chronic illnesses and so on. And it's interesting because the public health departments are totally oblivious to this. They thought that humans, in some places, they think that humans can't get brucella from cattle or from livestock or even from other humans. And that just is not true at all.
Well, of course, when I went to medical school, that was one of the things we learned. And, of course, that was one of the causes of chronic fever. And anybody you saw with a chronic fever, chronically ill, you always thought of brucella. Now, I've never seen a case, because I went into orthopedics, but certainly that was something we learned about many years ago. I guess it was so long ago that it's sort of almost been forgotten.
Well, I think that's part of the problem. I mean, education, medical school education is part of the problem. But there's also, I think, cycles in medicine and science and so on and so forth. And it's easy to forget some of the important things that are a few years ago. There's a new set of topics that seem to be more important, and you kind of push those in the background, and you don't really think about them too much. But they're still there. They haven't gone away. They're still causing problems. And it's if you forget about them too much, then they'll cause more and more problems, and then you can't ignore it.
Well, it seems to me that the incidence of this chronic fatigue syndrome, these chronic fibromyalgia, these chronic illnesses is really increasing all across America. Am I mistaken on that, or is this really a disease that is really having more and more of an influence?
Well, it's apparently increasing in incidence. I say apparently because, in fact, it's hard to find good data. Why? Because these weren't tracked previously, so we didn't really know how many or what percentage of people in the population had these diseases before. I personally think that they're actually increasing in incidence, and it's if you talk to old-time physicians who say the claim that in examining hundreds of thousands of patients that they rarely saw anything like this before 10 or 20 years ago, and now all of a sudden the incidence is really shooting up, and they can make very convincing arguments that these are on the increase, and they're increasing fairly rapidly.
But they seem to almost be in clusters. In other words, there's certain areas like the Incline Village or certain places in the east or south where I remember there was a story Hillary Johnson talks about, I think it was an orchestra, where a large number of the people in that orchestra all had the chronic fatigue syndrome.
Well, whenever you see this, you have to think of infections, because what causes clusters, either there's some toxic exposure, everybody is in a building, for example, it's a toxic building, or there's an infection that's being passed from individual to individual. And with chronic infections, these happen very slowly, so you don't really recognize that there's a problem until it becomes so widespread that you can't ignore it.
All right, so, but as far as you're concerned, there's no one organism. It seems to be a plethora of organisms, but are most of the people, the vast majority of them, infected with mycoplasma? I know you mentioned the Gulf War, about maybe 40% of the veterans, but what about the general population with chronic fatigue syndrome?
Well, there are about 50 to 60% of the chronic fatigue syndrome patients have this one type of infection. Also, in fibromyalgia patients, the number is even higher. We find about 70% have it. In some of the autoimmune diseases, it's even higher. For example, in ALS, it's close to 100%. Particularly in the Gulf War veterans, we found 100% of them have this type of infection. In the civilians, it's down more, 85, 90%. Multiple sclerosis is a very high percentage. So there are a lot of these autoimmune neurological diseases that seem to have this as a component. And you might ask why. Well, one of the things that's known about this type of infection is it's neurotropic, or it likes to invade nerve cells. And it can invade the peripheral nervous system, and that's where I think the problem arises with fibromyalgia, which is a very painful muscles and skin areas that there's very painful to the touch. And if the peripheral nerves are inflamed, this could be the explanation for it. Also, the central nervous system, when these infections get in the central nervous system, and they're documented to be able to get in the central nervous system. In fact, some of the classic papers come out of the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, where upon autopsy of soldiers that died of these infections, they found things like mycoplasma in the central nervous system. When they get there, they can cause all kinds of problems, autoimmune problems. These infections are very interesting because they're intracellular. They hide inside cells, like nerve cells, for example. And then when they finally come out, because the infectious agent itself doesn't have this thick, rigid wall like a normal bacteria, and when they come out, they kind of pop out of the cell membrane and take part of the membrane with it. Well, when they do that, they're actually delivering the host antigens, the cell membrane antigens, to our immune system. And when this happens, this can result in an autoimmune attack or autoimmune response. And this is what we think is part of the problem when you have these infections. And that's why so many people that have these infections show autoimmune signs and symptoms.
Well, now there are a number of different types of mycoplasms, and I suppose a lot of these have been around for a long time. But is there one specific type that is really associated with disease much more so than the others?
Well, there are a few species that we feel are associated with disease from our own studies and from others. And it's slightly different in different places. For example, in Europe, if we look at the species of mycoplasma, the most common one that we found in a study done in Belgium and also another study in Germany is Mycoplasma hominis. And we have some studies that are just coming out in various journals with the University of Brussels on this. On the other hand, in the United States, the most commonly found in chronic fatigue syndrome patients is Mycoplasma pneumoniae and Mycoplasma fermentans, not Mycoplasma hominis. So, again, different places you may have different types of infections. Other interesting fact is that the majority of patients have multiple mycoplasmal infections, not just one, but they have multiples. But almost all the multiples are either, in the case of the United States, they're with Mycoplasma fermentans. In Europe, they're multiples with Mycoplasma hominis. So, and fermentans. So, you know, there's a slightly different array of or constellation of different infections in different regions.
Well, what about the Gulf War illness that occurred in England and France and other parts of Europe that sent their troops over out of the Gulf? Are they infected with the mycoplasma as well?
Well, we just don't know because we haven't examined enough. We've examined some British veterans and some Australian veterans and so on and did find mycoplasma in those. But the British and the Australians did receive the vaccines, so we're not sure whether they got them. 6% of commercial vaccines are contaminated with mycoplasmas, and that's actually a published study. So we're not sure whether they got those mycoplasmas in the vaccines or they got them from the environment or whether they were actually part of the arsenal of offensive biological warfare agents that Saddam Hussein's forces had at their disposal. You know, one of the mysteries of the Gulf War that we've heard over and over and over again is that we keep hearing from our government that there was no detection of any biologic agents in the Gulf War. Well, guess what? We had no biologic weapons detection systems in the Gulf. So that kind of statement is particularly asinine, I think, because if you don't have detectors, naturally you're not going to detect anything. So that's the way we've kind of approached that problem, and I think it's totally ridiculous.
All right, fine. Well, what about the French? Did the French take the vaccines? Did the French get the chronic fatigue syndrome or the Gulf War illness?
No, they did not take the vaccines. The approach that the French forces used in the Gulf War was to use prophylactic antibiotics instead of the vaccines. And there were very few casualties reported in the deployed French forces. And we're trying to get more information about this because there were some casualties. There were some Gulf War illnesses that have now been reported in the French press. I'm trying to track the French officers, which were posted with American and British units as liaison officers, because they did, in all likelihood, receive the same vaccines as the rest of the forces. And so we're trying to get information on that, but it's very difficult.
I imagine it is. And yet, of course, the government has the facilities to do the extensive studies. You know, and when you try to do it, it's difficult, time-consuming, costly. And, of course, you're not getting much help, are you, from are you getting any help at all from the government doing your studies?
No. In fact, they've been less than helpful, I would say. We've had to compete, for example, with psychiatrists for money to study Gulf War illness. And, gee, I was very frustrated early on because 80% or more of the money went to psychiatrists to study psychiatric reasons for Gulf War illness. And early on, we didn't think that most of the Gulf War illness was due to psychiatric problems. And the reason for that is a lot of the people that we assisted early on were special forces, Navy SEALs, airborne rangers. I mean, these are not people that are prone to those kinds of problems. And also, a lot of them were officers, and the overwhelming majority had been to war before and had not had these same problems. So if you go to war before, you know what to expect. You're not going to have nearly the psychological hang-ups as somebody who's never gone to war before. So they were, that is, the soldiers themselves and the special forces themselves were, they were adamantly opposed to this notion that these were caused by post-traumatic stress disorder or some other psychological problems.
Now, of course, did they do fairly well on this overall regime that you've described?
Yes, they did. Actually, it did extremely well. And unfortunately, we haven't been able to do a large-scale study just from lack of money. And the only government study that was done, I think, was purposely sabotaged. And there were some very suspicious results along the way, and which I think is evidence that it was sabotaged. And I won't go into that. But
you're talking about the VA study. Is that the VA study?
Yes, that's the VA study. And physicians within the VA system reported to me that there were some very suspicious results about that study. And they found that even in the control studies, that the patients that were receiving placebo were reverting, for example, from a mycoplasma positive test to a mycoplasma negative test at the same rate as the ones that were receiving antibiotics. And we've never seen anything like that, and nor has anyone else to my knowledge. And so that only occurs when you start mixing changing the patients and putting them from one group to another.
Well, of course, we have seen that very, very similar things, unfortunately, happen with other studies. We won't get into that. But sometimes science can be misused if you're not dealing with honest people. I mean, the entire concept of a scientific study is based upon the integrity of the investigator. And sometimes we have people who are running these who have an agenda rather than a search for the knowledge and the real understanding of what's the basis of Gulf War illness. Now, let's talk a little bit about the ALS, because this is a different audience. And, of course, anterior lateral sclerosis, or Lou Gehrig's disease, is just a terrible, terrible disease. In fact, it's amazing how many people these seem to be coming down. This seems to really be on the rise, isn't it?
It is, and amyotrophic lateral sclerosis used to be a very unusual disease, of course, popularized by the fact that Lou Gehrig, a very famous baseball player, came down with this, but people thought it was a very rare disease, and now all of a sudden it's cropping up all over the place, and we stumble across a major problem that was going on, for example, even before the Gulf War in the state of Texas, where experiments on vaccines and, in fact, experiments on mycoplasmas were taking place in the prison system down there. And in these small towns that had prisons in East Texas, the small town meaning 25,000 or so people in the town, where most of the people seemed to work at the prisons, and all of a sudden there was an extremely high incidence of ALS. Four on one block, for example, was one example. There were 35, 40 cases in this one town alone. And here's a little town of 25,000, and the normal incidence is supposed to be 1 in 100,000 to 1 in 200,000. All of a sudden, there are 31 cases in a little town of 25,000. That's crazy. And all correlating to experiments that were being conducted at the prison system. And these were experiments that were denied for many years. And I know I've been called everything under the sun by the Texas prison system, but in fact, some of the former employees actually dug out the data to prove that I was right and that they were conducting illegal experiments and so on. And that's basically, there's some very brave families and employees of the Texas Department of Corrections that actually went public with this data recently.
And, of course, what's happened to those people? Have they gotten any sort of compensation for it? Or, have you been able to help them with some of the immune-enhancing treatments that you are suggesting?
Well, we were able to help some of them when I was still a professor down at the University of Texas. But since I moved from Texas, we've lost contact to all but a few. Some have actually left the state, retired from the prison system, and so on. There are people down there that know about the problem, but there's a tremendous ability to ignore things like this and sweep them under the carpet and just forget about them. You know, that's past history. Let's go on. Let's move on. But in fact, the diseases are still there. The infections are still there. They're still causing morbidity, still causing mortality, and nobody's doing anything about it.
Well, basically what happened then was that they unleashed this the disease into the community, and it spreads from there into other communities and to other people. Now, was this, as far as you can determine, was this an experiment to infect people with mycoplasma and then see if they could control it with vaccines, or, what was it all about?
Well, apparently that's what it was all about, and according to the prison records themselves, that is the prison board, which has to meet and decide on any medical experiments going on in the Texas prison system, they were developing vaccines against things like mycoplasma and other things as well. It's not just mycoplasma. They were doing a bunch of tests, presumably for pharmaceutical companies or for the Army or whatever, and that was one place they were doing it. There was only one major problem. They were violating all of the laws. They did not use informed consent. Nobody knew about these. That's why the prison guards started getting sick, and the people that worked in the infirmaries were getting sick, and even the administrators that worked there were getting sick. And sure enough, they were coming down with these chronic infections that they were testing in the prison system, and they were evidently trying to immunize prisoners, and then they were exposing them to aerosols of these agents. Well, that's just by giving them a biological warfare agent almost, and hoping that the vaccine will protect them. And in a lot of cases, it did not.
Oh, no, of course, was this mycoplasma, or was this some of these other chronic infections we're talking about?
Well, we know that mycoplasmas were part of the mix because the prison records indicate that. In fact, the minutes from the prison board meetings themselves indicate the approval for these types of tests. So we know that that went on. I mean, they can't deny it because the records are there. They're just plain as day.
Well, has anybody brought a lawsuit against the prisons, against the government? Because, of course, once again, this is a total violation not only of the Nuremberg protocols but of humanity itself.
Well, I don't know. Again, I've lost track of what's going on down there, but I do know that there were a lot of deaths associated with these programs, and I know that is a fact because one of the pathologists that I trained in my laboratory became director of the autopsy service at the University of Texas Medical Branch at Galveston, and by law, they were supposed to receive the remains of any prisoner that died in the state prison system for autopsy, and they just weren't getting these. These bodies were being sent to an army base outside of San Antonio, and my student started to complain about this, and guess what happened?
He died mysteriously. What happened?
He died mysteriously. And they still haven't figured out the cause of death. So it can be very dangerous getting involved in these kinds of things.
Well, I'm glad the Lord has preserved you because, of course, we need people really to educate the American people about what really goes on. These are the sort of things that the average person finds difficult to believe. I mean, this couldn't really go on in America. This is the sort of thing that, like a movie with Mel Gibson. But the truth of the matter is we live in a world that really is it's a very violent world. And sometimes those who do speak out and try to get the truth out can come under tremendous, tremendous pressure. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question or comment on what we're talking about, our guest this evening is Dr. Garth Nicholson, who was for many, many years professor at MD Anderson Clinic in Texas, and now, of course, he is with the Institute of Molecular Medicine in Southern California. And if you'd like to get in touch with them, their telephone number is 714-903-2900. That's 714-903-2900. And, of course, the website is immed.org. That's immed.org. All sorts of information there that you'll want to have. You want to study, and it has the endorsement of Theodore, and I don't say that lightly at all. Theodore is a very objective individual, and if she is has gone through all of that, I'm sure that it's got information on it that will be important for everybody to access. Well, now, you know, really, we've heard this story. This was actually about Huntsville, wasn't it? Did this sort of thing take place in any other towns in Texas, these macabre experiments on the prisoners without their consent or knowledge?
We think that they did, at least in two or three other locations, but we had the most information and the most contact with people from Huntsville. There are three prisons around the Huntsville area. The one that we had the most contact with because of the guards and essentially the administrators there were coming to us. There's one unit there called the Walls Unit in the main prison there. The Walls Unit is a condemned prisoner unit. We think a lot of the testing went on there and went on in some of the other units, the high security units. And the reason for that is that in the high security units, the prisoners are kept isolated. So they're in a more controlled environment, and I think they tried to use that for their tests.
All right, fine. Now, of course, you've actually had the opportunity of evaluating a number of patients with ALS, and what was it about? Was it almost 100% of the Gulf War veterans and most of the civilians had mycoplasma? Was this a fermentans, or was this another type of mycoplasma?
Most of them were mycoplasma fermentans. In fact, almost all the Gulf War veterans, except for one that had Mycoplasma genitalium, had Mycoplasma fermentans. The civilians were kind of mixed. There were many Mycoplasma fermentans and, to a lesser degree, Mycoplasma hominis. These are the two that we think are very important as neurotropic infections. There were also some Mycoplasma pneumoniae. But in the case of the civilians, about 85% of the ALS patients had one of these three species of mycoplasmal infections. The Gulf War veterans, they generally had this one, and that's it. And that correlates with what we find in the chronic illnesses. Now, the interesting thing about ALS was they also had another infection, a viral infection, that appeared as a co-infection with the mycoplasmal infection.
Well, we're going to have to interrupt you, so hopefully everybody will want to hang on until we get back from our break to find out about the viral infection of the co-infection, because so many of these appear to be several infections, each one seeming to aid the other in the progress of the disease. We'll be back here in just a moment with Dr. Garth Nicholson. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you out there will really want to join the Radio Liberty family, and that's how we are able to do what we do 5 hours a day, and then we do two programs on Saturday, one pre-recorded, and the other, of course, done on a regular basis, a live program tomorrow morning, which will be heard if you're out there across America and like to hear it. It'll be www.wxbh.com. That's wxbh.com. And we'll be having our special guest, Colonel Ron Ray, talking about the effort to undermine the moral fabric of the American military by removing any mention of God in either the courses or in the routine prayers that have been used in military institutions since the origin of this country. But of course, there is a conspiracy against God as well as a conspiracy against man. And of course, we'll be discussing that tomorrow morning and you can hear it on the internet at wxbh.com starting at 10 o'clock Pacific time. And, of course, we have a program tomorrow morning on KKMC.com. I believe it's at 11:30. And, of course, our program in Northern California at 7:40 a.m. And that will, of course, be at 10:30. I don't know that they have a website, but anyway, it's 7:70 a.m. Out of Modesto, and it can be heard in Northern California. Well, of course, all of these things we do are expensive. But we do it because we think it's important to get the truth out across America. And we have, fortunately, access to people who have a great deal of experience on so many different aspects of what's going on today. And, of course, without knowledge, there's no way people can have even catch a glimpse of what's really transpiring. And, of course, so much of what we know is simply an illusion. Our attention is being focused by the mass media on this issue or that issue or this threat or that threat. And yet, of course, to see the overall picture, to see the big picture is what we try to do. And certainly pointing out the fact we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, cultural, medical, scientific battlefield. And that people don't even know the battle is going on, but our job is to make them understand. And at first they may think we're crazy. After a while, many of them begin to fear that we're not. And, of course, listening to our guests that we have this evening, Dr. Nicholson, with over 500 peer-reviewed articles, certainly is one of the outstanding scientists in the country. Now, if you'd like to become part of our team, why, you can certainly give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to go to our website, it's radioliberty.com, and you can pull down our articles there. Our monthly articles, other things we've written. You can find a number of our programs that are archived there. You can listen to us live on the internet, on radioliberty.com 3 hours a day, on americannewsnet.com at 7 o'clock Pacific every morning, weekday morning, on Genesis or GCNlive.com. That's GCNlive.com at 3 o'clock in the afternoon Pacific time. And then our 4 to 5 and evening programs here are heard on shortwave, satellite, internet, and there's, of course, on radio. If you'd like to become part of our team and help us to get the truth out, our number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America, our family, our freedom, our future are under attack today. Well, Dr. Stan back here. Our guest this evening is Dr. Garth Nicholson. We're talking about right now about ALS, and this is a terrible, terrible, devastating disease. Many times it attacks young people, at the height of their lives, and I've seen it attack wife of a very good friend, and just see her progressively degenerate until eventually she couldn't either eat or breathe and eventually just slip away. A terrible, terrible disease. Now, Dr. Nicholson is pointing out that those that he's studying, so many of the ALS patients, whether they be Gulf War veterans, and incidentally, there's a very high incidence proportional to the general population of ALS in the Gulf War. And I understand the government has recognized the relationship between Gulf War and ALS.
Well, yes, they have. They can't really deny it because the numbers of ALS patients are about, or at least 2.5 times the expected number in that cohort of age-matched individuals. So they do recognize that, that if you served in the Gulf War, you're at a much higher risk for coming down with ALS.
And so they actually are at least giving at least that group of people some help and compensation.
Well, I think that that's the next step. Once it's identified as something that's related to the Gulf War, unfortunately, they're still denying the overwhelming number of people that are sick with a variety of different Gulf War illnesses, but it's a start. In our studies on the Gulf War veterans that have ALS, again, I mentioned that 100% of them had this one bacterial infection. They also had another co-infection that was kind of interesting. This is a virus that's related to poliovirus. It's not a poliovirus, but it's related. It's called an Echo 7 virus. And it's been studied in France and in Germany, and it's also been associated with ALS there. We also found that association here. So if I could just say anything about ALS from our studies, it's that these two types of infections seem to be very, very important in ALS. Now, there's probably some underlying genetic susceptibility issues that we don't understand as well, but those are certainly two that go along with practically every patient.
Well, where would they have gotten this Echo 7 type of a virus? I've never even heard of it before.
Well, we just don't know. Again, this is in the poliovirus family, and so we don't know whether they got this from vaccines or whether they picked it up somewhere. The thing about the mycoplasmas, they're an airborne infection, so you can virtually pick these things up anywhere as an airborne infection. They're not considered highly contagious, so it seems to require either prolonged contact or fairly high titer of it to really get infected. But eventually, you know, you'll get it. It can be sexually transmitted. Since it's an airborne infection, close family members can get it. We've seen a lot of healthcare professionals that have come down with these types of infections. We've seen teachers that have come down with the infections and so on. So there are certain types of occupations where I believe that people are at higher risk due to their contact with the general public.
Well, what's the incidence of mycoplasma in the general public? And I'm talking about people, you know, just don't have any disease at all.
Well, if you talk about single infections, which is a little bit different from the multiple infections, because we don't find multiple mycoplasmal infections in these control groups, about 1% of the population in our control studies will show some evidence of a single species of mycoplasma, but no multiple infections.
No, multiple mycoplasma infections.
Correct.
In other words, you're talking about hominis and fermentis and pneumonia and all of these.
Yes.
And fermentans, I guess it is.
Yes. And if you start adding them all up, you can end up with an incidence of 6% or even as high as some people have reported, 8%. And these are people that are asymptomatic, I think, because they have low titers, because they have only one infection, compared to somebody, let's say, with rheumatoid arthritis or chronic fatigue syndrome, where the overwhelming majority of patients have multiple infections, 2, 3 or more different infections.
Now, are these different mycoplasma infections, or are these viral infections and these other infections you've been talking about?
Both. We find that the most common thing in, for example, rheumatoid arthritis and chronic fatigue syndrome are multiple mycoplasmal infections. 2, sometimes 3, sometimes even more different species. On top of that, then you can have also viral infections as well. So when you start adding that all up, the overwhelming majority of patients have multiple infections of bacteria and viruses.
Well, now, of course, I remember many years ago when I was over in Africa practicing medicine, reading articles about, you know, treating rheumatoid arthritis with antibiotics. Is this done at all? Do some people respond to antibiotic treatment?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, there's a whole foundation that deals with antibiotic treatment of rheumatoid arthritis. It's called the Road Back Foundation. I'm one of their scientific advisors. In fact, their next newsletter will have an article by me. That foundation, which is a charitable foundation, there again, you can find them on the World Wide Web on Road Back. I think it's roadback.org. They have information about the treatment of these chronic infections in rheumatoid arthritis patients. And actually, there are two NIH trials that have been conducted that showed the efficacy of antibiotic treatment with minocycline for rheumatoid arthritis.
What sort of percentage would you get a response? Would that be half or 25%? Or?
They were getting responses in about half the patients, and that corresponds with the percentage of mycoplasmal infected patients as well, although in those trials, they didn't have the diagnostic workup that we've used to determine whether patients are infected or not.
And because, you know, rheumatoid arthritis is really such a terrible, terrible disease and just so debilitating. And you, of course, as an orthopedic surgeon, we used to explore the joints and replace them. And, you know, just that everything is gone. The synovium just invades like almost like a cancer and erodes away the cartilage. But the fact that you could actually reverse that with antibiotics is pretty is an exciting thing. And certainly, I don't remember that ever being used routinely. This must be something fairly recent, is it?
Well, actually, there was a Dr. Brown, for example, many years ago,
right,
who first started this with the notion that things like mycoplasmas and other infections were behind rheumatoid arthritis and started prescribing his patients starting in Maryland, in Baltimore, using antibiotics to treat rheumatoid arthritis patients. And for a while there, he had quite a following. Of course, when he passed away, then a lot of it sort of, I think, went by the wayside. But there are other people like Carol Clark, who's in Florida, who's a researcher, a mycoplasma researcher, who's sort of continued this for many years. He's now retired as well. But over the years, they've gathered a lot of information about these types of infections in rheumatoid arthritis patients.
All right, we've got Mike calling from Santa Cruz. Mike, how are you?
Good, Stan. I wanted to ask one question about probably a very obscure thing called Q fever. It might date back at least to the 60s.
All right. Well, this is one of the biological warfare agents.
Yes, we discussed this earlier in the program. Coxiella infections cause Q fever, and Coxiella is one of the weapons in our arsenal, one of the incapacitating agents that have been studied by the U.S. Army for use in biological warfare.
Okay, I missed the early part of the program.
All right, now, is this a factor in any of the patients that you're dealing with?
Well, we found some of the Gulf War veterans that had these types of infections. We just don't know because we haven't examined really enough patients, and you know, there's just not the funding available to do this in a comprehensive way.
Okay, anything else, Mike?
Well, could he describe the Q fever just to be sure we're talking about the same thing?
Well, Q fever starts out as a kind of a nondescript disease with fever, for example, and it progresses into a more chronic phase, and in that chronic phase, sometimes associated or sometimes mistakenly caused undulating fever, because undulating fever, of course, is caused by Brucella. But Q fever is caused by the bacteria Coxiella burnetii.
Was it a tick infection or what?
Well, you can get this directly, for example, from animals, and commonly this has been obtained out in the civilian form from goats, sheep, and cattle. The disease develops very slowly, and it involves, of course, fevers, malaise, headache, muscle pain, and soreness. And generally, these are the nonspecific signs and symptoms that occur with a lot of the chronic infections. About half of the patients that have Q fever will have a pneumonia with a heavy cough, labored cough, and chest pain. And in some cases, the disease can actually invade the central organs and even cause hepatitis. And so, you know, there is a danger that this can cause organ failure. And so it needs to be treated.
Would you call this a manufactured disease?
Well, again, this is one of the biologic weapons that has been worked on by the U.S. Army as a biologic weapon. It is in other countries' arsenals as well as an incapacitating agent.
But of course, it's a natural occurring disease. But You know, it has been used for biological warfare. Anything else?
Well, a few other things appear to be naturally occurring, and they're manufactured after that.
Well, practically all of all the ones that I know of, the biological warfare agents started out as a naturally occurring disease-causing agent, and they were actually chosen for their ability to cause disease, and then they were further selected for their pathogenic properties, and they were weaponized, that is, they were turned into weapons that they could disseminate, for example, in aerosols and dispersing weapons of various sorts, from missiles to, you know, sprayers mounted on aircraft and so on and so forth, and that would survive much more readily under those conditions than the natural pathogen. Mm-hmm. So that's a weaponized version, and so a lot of these things have been weaponized.
Okay, anything else?
Well, does the Q fever resemble mononucleosis?
Well, it can. As I mentioned, some of the signs and symptoms are similar. Again, a lot of these infections like this, it's difficult just from the signs and symptoms to absolutely positively distinguish between them until laboratory tests are done to actually find out what's there. And unfortunately, in a lot of cases, there are multiple infections, so that really complicates the assessment.
Yeah. Okay.
Thanks so much, Mike. And let's go to Susan calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Susan. How are you doing?
Hi there. Thanks. Fine. Dr. Nicholson, you said that people that hang around ALS patients eventually get it?
No, I didn't say that. That's a very, I think, an unusual situation where a given patient has these two types of infections, and the location of the infections are very important. These infections have to be able to invade into the central nervous system, and further yet, they have to really invade into the more or less the brain stem, which is where the cells that actually cause the ALS start to die and
mm-hmm.
cause a loss of motor function and so on. So I think that people that take care of ALS patients may be at risk for one of these infections, I'd say. But I doubt if they're going to get the same complement and they have the same genetic background, which I think is also important in ALS,
mm-hmm.
as the ALS patient.
Now, your lab tests for these things, right?
Yes. We have fully certified reference diagnostic laboratory that does this type of testing. Although it's affiliated with the Institute for Molecular Medicine, it's really a separate entity, and it's strictly a commercial laboratory that has all the commercial licenses, and it's been inspected by the U.S. government and by the American College of Pathologists and so on, and it has all those certifications, and so it can accept Medicare and Medicaid, and here in California, Medi-Cal, and so on. It's recognized by, for example, California Children's Services as a provider. It's recognized by the normal providers and insurance companies like Blue Cross and Blue Shield and so on.
Mm-hmm. So your lab is probably one of the few that has the ability to check for the range of mycoplasmal infections and things.
Well, it's one of the few reference laboratories that can really do a good job in identifying these chronic infections, yes,
mm-hmm.
both viral and bacterial. And it's also one of the few laboratories that can test for some of the common biological warfare agents as well. In fact, things like Yersinia pestis, if you thought that you were, hit with plague, which is a bacterium that, of course, killed a third of Europe during the Middle Ages,
mm-hmm.
And has some characteristic signs and symptoms, you wouldn't know where to go to get tested because
mm-hmm.
nobody has those kinds of tests.
Mm-hmm.
But we do. In fact, the FBI knows this. The Secret Service knows this. If you have one of these very unusual infections, they know where to go.
They go to you?
Yes, they do.
Ah.
Okay, anything else, Susan?
That's it. Thank you very much.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Unfortunately, you're a little ways away from here if we really had to use you. And of course, we can get blood sent down. Packed in ice, you have to know how to do it, and can be taken care of. So if you have a question about sending a specimen down, the telephone number is 714-903-2900. How much of a problem is chlamydia today? Because this wasn't even known when I went to medical school, and now because we're hearing more and more about chlamydia infection and the part that it plays in chronic disease. And the,
well,
the
not only chronic disease, we were talking in one of our other programs about heart disease, the ability of things like chlamydia and mycoplasma to invade into the heart tissue and cause endocarditis, myocarditis, and other heart conditions. And I know this very well because my own father suffered from this. He had a mycoplasma pneumonia infection that settled in his heart and caused endocarditis and eventually destroyed his heart valve, one of his major valves that had to be replaced. And so this was a chronic problem that he had for some time. But once we solved that problem and he was adequately treated, he looks like a new individual. He's 90 years old now and doing extremely well. There are a lot of people that never have these conditions properly diagnosed. They might have a chlamydial or mycoplasmal infection, and their heart becomes a target. And once that happens, they end up with all kinds of arrhythmias, all kinds of inflammation. They have an inflammation process that actually results in their heart increasing in size. There's so much inflammation going on. And most physicians just don't know what to do with it. They don't know how to deal with it. And consequently, they don't get the proper care that they need. And eventually, this can lead to major heart failure.
All right, fine. And one of the things that really amazed me is that apparently the chlamydia can even produce some plaques in the arteries, can't it?
Oh, yes. I didn't really get into that as well, but chlamydia are associated with plaque formation in arteries, of course, leading to arteriosclerosis. We think also mycoplasmas do the same thing. These types of infections invade the blood vessels, the endothelial cells that line the blood, and this is where it all starts, because once they invade those endothelial cells and set up an inflammation there, this is what triggers the plaque formation. This is what triggers the autoimmune attack and the whole problems that we know are associated with heart disease. Stroke is another thing that we think may also involve in some cases these types of infections, because they cause a hypercoagulation state because of their vascular inflammation, and so all of these things tend to compound. And so if somebody, for example, has chronic fatigue syndrome, they may not know it, but they're also at risk for long-term heart problems, and if they have these infections, they need to be taken care of.
And, of course, the major approach would be to try to get their immune system really straightened out, as well as simply the use of antibiotics. So it would be sort of a combined approach?
Well, that's what we recommend, is that none of the single-minded approaches seem to be adequate. You need to have a comprehensive approach, and I mentioned things like antibiotics, a diet, for example, immune enhancement agents, and other supplements, and so on, to improve the system, improve your health, probiotics to improve your digestive system, and to cut down on the leaky gut problems, and so on. All these things play a role.
All right, fine. And of course, you can find all of those things if you go to Dr. Garth Nicholson's website at immed.org. That's immed.org. Or you can sort of remember it as he does. He says, like, immediate, but that's immed for the institution of Institute of Molecular
Institute medicine, for right? Molecular Medicine.
Right. Okay, fine. Well, we've only got a couple of minutes more before we have to let you go. What are some of the other issues? Are there other really important issues that you'd like to discuss this evening?
Well, we've kind of talked about some very important general issues. We've talked about autoimmune diseases and chronic illnesses in general. And I want to just go back and say that we also study some of the viruses that seem to be involved in these processes as well. So it's not just chlamydia, it's not just mycoplasma, it's not just, in the case of Lyme disease, Borrelia, and so on. It's these multiple infections that seem to be important. And we haven't really spent much time on the viruses, but there are whole families of different viruses, some in the herpes group, for example. We discussed a little bit about viruses in the polio group and so on, that play a role in these chronic illnesses. And this is just beginning to be known, that the combination of certain viruses and certain bacteria are really deleterious to your health, and that when these get loose in your body, it's very hard to treat. Now, what do we recommend for the viruses? Now, obviously, there's some new antiviral agents out there that have been used. We don't initially recommend that approach. We initially recommend the immune enhancement approach for the viruses. And the main reason because that many of these antivirals have really quite dramatic side effects. And the percentages, the prevalence of the side effects is really a lot higher than the antibiotics that we've recommended. So you have to be very careful of that and seek your physician's advice, even if you're interested in pursuing that. But the safest thing seems to be immune enhancement, because there are a number of these immune enhancement products made by and produced by a number of different reputable organizations out there that seem to do a very good job in suppressing these types of infections. So that's the approach we recommend first.
Okay, and finally, of course, when you're dealing with a multiple infection program and you can't treat all of them specifically, it's far better to get the immune system working than to be trying to juggle which virus or which antibiotic, which mycoplasm or chlamydia we're going to treat?
Well, first is diet. It starts there, because we have to have the appropriate diet, or no matter what treatment, you're just not going to put a dent in the problem in terms of the long-term recovery. So once the diet has changed, then we can more or less attack the infections by building the immune system. Then we may need some very specific types of drugs, like antibiotics, for example, or in some cases antivirals to attack either bacteria or viruses. We haven't talked much about fungal infections, but these are also a problem, and many patients have fungal infection, and there's some actually pretty good antifungal agents that can be used to suppress those fungal infections, but in some cases the fungal infections can become a major problem in people with chronic illnesses.
And how do you make the diagnosis? I mean, certainly, again, they do this laboratory test. Will you actually see the manifestations on the skin?
Well, in the case of the fungal infections, if they're superficial, of course you can get them, in the skin, the oral cavity, the gut, and so on. And there are certain drugs, for example, like nystatin, that can be used to treat gut-associated fungal infections, and it doesn't really enter the body very much, so it's a very safe drug. There are other drugs that can be used to treat systemic fungal infections, and if you take a drop of blood and just examine it under a microscope slide, if there are fungal forms, and they're very distinctive in terms of their morphology, in the blood sample, you can bet that the person has a systemic a fungal infection, and when this happens, they generally need to be treated.
Well, how often would you find that, and how often would the laboratory actually do that, look for them? Would they see it up when they were just doing a smear for a white count or something of that sort?
You can actually see it, and if a person is really heavily infected, you can actually see it very easily on a smear. Usually, these are seen more readily under dark field microscopy.
All right, fine. Well, look, we're out of time, but thank you so much. I know you've had a hard day, and I appreciate so much your spending the 2 hours with us. It's been a fascinating time, and I hope we can call on you again sometime in the future.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me on your program again.
Good night. God bless you. Okay, fine. That was Dr. Garth Nicholson, and of course, remember, is immed.org, and we recommend the material that he has there. And then we ask you to pray for America, and pray for revival, pray for our leaders, and please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. I'm going to be gone for a little while, for about 10 days or so, but we'll be having some fascinating programs in my absence. Until then, may the Lord be with you.
There's no fishing. open the door for it.